To the Gospel of John, the 9th chapter, and our study will be based on that text in a few minutes, John chapter 9. Beginning the first of the year, we began reading through various books of the Bible by a schedule that we have suggested, and I made a promise that I would try to have a lesson each month based upon the book that we were reading. And we come to the very last Sunday of December, and I realized that I had not covered or had a lesson in the Gospel of John, and so our lesson today. And I realized that this is probably not very good timing because we have had a mass exodus of our own members, but nonetheless, we're glad that you're here, and for our guests, we're glad, and we know that you will get something, hopefully, out of the text that we want to consider in John chapter 9. I appreciate Scott leading the singing for us today. And we'll just keep the door open. You can come back anytime. I know Mom would be glad for you to be back tomorrow. And I do appreciate the song service and appreciate your willingness to try to coordinate the song with some of the things that we're going to talk about today. Most of us know that John, of course, presents Jesus as God in the flesh. In the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God. And the Word was God. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among men. And He is the only begotten Son of the Father, full of grace and truth. And John presents evidence to cause us, to help us to believe that Jesus was indeed God in the flesh. In fact, in the 20th chapter and the 30 verses 30 and 31, He tells us why He wrote the book. He says, "Truly Jesus did many other signs in the presence of His disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written, that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in His name." The claims were made. And John has said, we have offered enough evidence, sufficient evidence, to cause you to believe that He is indeed the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in His name. Most of us recognize, very candidly though, the Gospel of John reveals that many of those, even in Jesus' day, did not believe in Him. The Pharisees and the Jews, many of them rejected the claim that He made to be the Son of God. Unfortunately, that is also true today. That while Jesus wants the world to believe in Him and to believe all that He has to offer, there are many that will reject Him and many that will not believe. Today what I want to do is talk about what willful unbelief does with a miracle. But before I do that, I want you to consider with me a couple of examples of unbelief. And the first one is found in John, the 3rd chapter, in verse 12. You may recall upon this occasion, Jesus is having an interview with Nicodemus. And Jesus makes this observation. He says, "If I have told you earthly things and you do not believe, how will you believe if I tell you heavenly things?" Now, Nicodemus was a good man. He had concluded that no man could do the signs that Jesus did except God be with him. But nonetheless, Jesus dispels and refers to announce an inkling of unbelief here. In the book of John, the 5th chapter and the 44th verse, there is another example of unbelief where Jesus is talking to the Jews. And He says, "How can you believe who receive honor from one another and do not seek the honor that comes from the only God?" He says, you sort of pat yourself on the back. They thought they were God's gift to man. They thought that no one could tell them anything. And therefore, He says, you receive honor from one another, but do not seek the honor that comes from God. And because of that, they refuse to believe. I would like to suggest to you that there are two examples here of unbelief, but there is a difference. The unbelief of Nicodemus was the unbelief of ignorance. Nicodemus was a seeking man. He was really wanting to know and desiring to know what God wanted him to know. Thus, his unbelief was simply because he hadn't heard the truth. But the unbelief of the Pharisees was a different kind of belief. It was a willful unbelief. And we find an example of that in the 9th chapter of the Gospel of John. You may recall upon this occasion that in John chapter 9, Jesus had performed a miracle. The miracle is recorded in the first 12 verses of the chapter. Here was a man who was born blind. Jesus took saliva and he made clay and he put it in his eyes, and he instructed this man that he was to go and wash in the pool of Siloam, which he did. And when he came up out of that washing, suddenly this man who had never seen before was now able to see. Thus, in the 13th verse, we find an investigation begins. In verse 13, it says, "They brought him who formerly was blind to the Pharisees." Now, there are a number of reasons why they would come to these men. First of all, because they were confused. Because many of them deemed the Pharisees to be the final authority in religion. Whatever they said surely must be gospel. They looked to them for answers because they were deemed to be the experts. But there may have been a positive reason as to why they came to the Pharisees. And that is, number two, because the Jews had said that Jesus was a fake. That Jesus was a fraud. And so, they want to know what Jesus is going to do with this man who was born blind, who can suddenly see. What's he going to do with it? But the third reason was perhaps a negative reason. And that is that they wanted to know what Jesus was going to do with the charge that he had violated the Sabbath. And I think the third is probably the most likely. You see, the first example, or the first characteristic of unbelief, the first characteristic of willful unbelief is that it begins by establishing a false standard. Notice what the text says, beginning in verse 14. "Now it was a Sabbath when Jesus made the clay and opened his eyes." And then the Pharisees also asked him how he had received his sight. And he said to them, "He put clay on my eyes, and I washed, and I see." Therefore, some of the Pharisees said, "This man is not from God, because he does not keep the Sabbath." Others said, "How can a man who is a sinner do such signs?" And there was a division among them. They began, first of all, by establishing a false standard. You see, the Pharisees had all kinds of rules and regulations on the Sabbath that were not a part of God's Sabbath law at all. And one of them was that the only kind of healing that could be done upon the Sabbath was only if the injury was life-threatening. And so they had charged Jesus with healing on the Sabbath, that is, with violating their law, with violating the Sabbath. They began with a false standard. I want you to hold your place there, and I want you to look in the book of Luke. In Luke, the 6th chapter, we find another example of this. There were several of them in the gospel accounts. And I begin in Luke chapter 6 and verse 6. Luke 6, verse 6. "Now it happened on another Sabbath also that he entered the synagogue and taught, and a man was there whose right hand was withered. So the scribes and Pharisees watched him closely, whether he would heal on the Sabbath, that they might find an accusation against him. But he knew their thoughts, and said to the man who had the withered hand, 'Arise and stand here.' And he rose and stood. Then Jesus said to them, 'I will ask you one thing. Is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do evil, to save life or destroy?' And when he had looked around at them all, he said to the man, 'Stretch out your hand.' And he did so, and his hand was restored as whole as the other. But they were filled with rage and discussed with one another what they might do with Jesus." The question that Jesus asked, I think, answers the question, basically. Jesus said, "Is it lawful to do good or evil on the Sabbath?" You see, with all the rules and regulations that the Jews had made, they had made the Sabbath into bondage. But what God intended was rest. In the Gospel of Mark, the 2nd chapter, we find another example. Mark chapter 2. Mark chapter 2 and verse 27. Mark 2:27, where Jesus very candidly said, after the disciples had plucked grain upon the Sabbath. He said, "The Sabbath was made for man, and not man for the Sabbath. Therefore, the Son of Man is also Lord of the Sabbath." The very last statement is that I'm the one who is Lord of the Sabbath, and I can do what I want to on the Sabbath. But nonetheless, in verse 27, Jesus said, "The Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath." They had made the Sabbath into bondage, when in reality what Jesus intended was rest. Thus, when we go back to John 9, we find the charge against Jesus is false. Why? He heals on the Sabbath. What unbelief does is it begins with a false standard. Jamie mentioned, for example, the religion of Calvinism. It begins with a false standard. It begins with the false premise that man is so totally depraved that he cannot exalt and in any way come to God or react to God's commandments. Therefore, they come to the false conclusion that human implementation is not at all involved in the redemption of man. A number of examples like that. Consider with me one example here. Sir Julian Huxley, a well-known evolutionist. He says, Darwinism removed the whole idea of God as the creator of organisms from the sphere of rational discussion. We can dismiss entirely all ideas of a supernatural overriding mind being responsible for the evolutionary process. A very candid revelation here. He says, any idea of God or any idea of a supernatural creator is simply dismissed as being irrational. Thus, you have an unbeliever that begins with a false standard. They begin with a false standard. There is no possibility, they tell us, of a supernatural creator. And thus the idea goes on and on. But let's go back to John 9. In John 9, the second characteristic of willful unbelief is it wants more evidence. We don't have enough. We got to see more. Reminds me of a discussion I had a while back on the campus with a young man who said, "I don't go on a blind faith. If I don't see it, I don't believe it." And of course, no one can live consistently by that standard. And we talked about that fact. But look in John chapter 9 and consider with me, beginning in the 17th verse. After the interview with the blind man, well, again in verse 17, they said to the blind man again, "What do you say about him because he opened your eyes?" And he said, "He's a prophet." Quite a revelation. What do you say about him? "Well, he must be from God." That was the conclusion. He must be a prophet. Well, that's not enough. In verse 18, "But the Jews did not believe concerning him that he had been blind and received his sight until they called the parents of him who had received..." We don't have enough evidence. We've got to find more. And so in verse 19, "They asked them, saying, 'Is this your son who you say was born blind? How then does he now see?' His parents answered them and said, 'We know that this is our son, that he was born blind. But by what means he now sees, we do not know. Or who opened his eyes, we do not know. He is of age. Ask him. He will speak for himself.' And his parents said these things because they feared the Jews, for the Jews had agreed already that if anyone confessed that he was Christ, he would be put out of the synagogue." You see the digression here and progression? Here is a man standing before them. In fact, it's interesting, if you sort of casually scan the text that we have looked at again, notice verse 14, "He had received his sight." Notice verse 17. "They said, 'What do you say about him, the one who opened his eyes?' And again in verse 19, how does he see? And again verse 21, by what means how he sees we do not know, or who opened his eyes we do not know. Again, over and over again, even the very enemies of Jesus were acknowledging that here was a blind man who is now seeing. But it's not enough. We've got to know more. And so they continued to ask over and over and over again. How is it possible? You see, here what we have is indisputable facts. As John Adams said, facts are stubborn things. Here are the indisputable facts right before them. A man born blind who now sees. We have only several possibilities. His healing was psychological, his healing was medical, or it was supernatural. And the third is the only possible conclusion that they could have come to. But they want to know more. They have not had enough. Look in the book of Romans chapter 1. Because what that reminds me of a statement made in Romans 1 by Paul in verses 20 and 21. Romans 1 verses 20 and 21. For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse, because although they knew God, they did not glorify Him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. The Gentiles had all the evidence, Paul said, and they are without excuse, considering all of God's creation, and yet they refuse to believe. They need to know more. See the movie Contact, Jodie Foster, who plays a scientist who works for the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, SETI they called it, which is, by the way, a real organization where scientists have listened to the stars for an unmistakable sign of intelligent life. How ironic. They are listening to the stars for an unmistakable sign of some intelligent life. If they would just simply look at the creation, they would know. There is a God. There's a Creator. Oh no, that's not enough. We got to know more. The very indisputable fact before these Pharisees, and yet incredibly, they refused to believe. They wouldn't believe. The third characteristic of willful unbelief is it does biased research. I think we would all understand, but by casual reading of the text, this was the case. They had already come to the conclusion that Jesus had violated the Sabbath. They were determined by their own bias to disprove every claim that He had made. And yet, they couldn't, because the facts were before them. Thus, in the 19th verse, again, they ask His parents, saying, "Is this your son who was born blind? How does he now see?" His parents answered and said to them, "We know that this is our son, and that he was born blind, but by what means he now sees, we do not know. Or who opened his eyes, we do not know. He is of age. Ask him. He will speak for himself." His parents said these things because they feared the Jews, for the Jews had agreed already that if anyone confessed that he was Christ, he would be put out of the synagogue. Therefore, his parents said, "He is of age, ask him." And in verse 24, they said again, they again called the man who was blind, and they said to him, "Give God the glory. We know this man is a sinner." You see the bias? I mean, here is the evidence before them, but they are not going to listen to it. We know this man is a sinner. You need to give God the glory. And he answered and said, whether he is a sinner or not, I do not know, but one thing I know, that though I was blind, now I see. And they said to him again, what did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? Again, they cannot deny the miracle. How is it that you see? They will not receive the obvious evidence. And he answered and said, I told you already and you didn't listen. I've already told you wouldn't listen to me. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you also want to become his disciples? And they reviled him and said, you are his disciple, but we are Moses' disciple. And so, because of biased research, they came to a false conclusion. Why, this Jesus is a sinner. Give God the glory. Seeing eyes aside. Obvious evidence aside. Indisputable facts aside. Witnesses aside. They were not going to hear it or receive it. Let's suppose that I embark upon a case of foolishness. Maybe I get a government grant. That'd be probably possible nowadays. And my research is that I'm going to prove that 4 plus 4 equals 13 and a half. That's going to be my research. And I do my research, and I've been 20 years devoted to proving that 4 plus 4 is 13 and a half. And every time I come up with the same conclusion, I put four fingers up and four fingers up, and I do everything I can to prove that 4 plus 4 is 13 and a half. And finally, I just say, well, that's my conclusion. You would call me foolish, would you not? The same is true with reference to the willful unbeliever. They begin with a very subjective bias, a very subjective standard. And there are many modern examples. For example, some simply do not know what to do with Jesus. So some man writes the Passover plot, in which he was determined that Jesus was a fake. That was the beginning of his conclusion, and he was determined that he was going to prove that indeed Jesus was a fake. Consider this interesting quotation from Francis Crick. We know him as, of course, the co-discoverer of DNA. He said, Darwinian biologists must constantly keep in mind that what they see was not designed, but rather evolved. You get that? We have to constantly remind ourselves that in all of this design, there is no design, nor designer, nor creator. Here is the man who was the co-discoverer of the amazing molecule DNA, and yet he has concluded that what we have to remind ourselves of is that behind all of this design is certainly no creator or designer. That was the example, that was the very kind of biased research that these Pharisees did with Jesus. And so, they said, how did he open your eyes? And finally, in frustration, he said, I told you, and you wouldn't listen to me. Why do you want to hear it again? Perhaps you want to become his disciples. And they were raised at him. You are a disciple, but we are Moses' disciple. And ultimately, in verse 34, they answered and said to him, you were completely born in sins, and you are teaching us? And they cast him out. Again, they used their bias to cast out the obvious evidence. I trust that we are not of that kind. I hope that we're not of that kind. The Apostle Paul says in Titus chapter 1 and verse 15. In Titus chapter 1 and verse 15. To the pure, all things are pure. But to those who are defiled and unbelieving, nothing is pure. But even their mind and conscience are defiled. There are some people who simply will not believe because they do not want to believe. They simply don't want to. They deny the obvious evidence. But I trust that that's not our mindset. I trust that our hearts are open to God's wonderful and obvious testimony. A few days ago, my son lost a high school friend. And the saddest part about that young man and the accident that he had in the Devil River Canyon a few days ago on an ATV and died was that very young man sat in my living room on a couch and heard the testimony of Jesus from the Gospel of Luke and died and did not accept it. Jesus has so much to offer. So much to offer. So much hope and consolation. Why do men refuse Him? Why do they refuse Him? Perhaps here today, your heart is open. You're willing to receive. And if that be the case, we certainly would welcome the opportunity to help you to come to know Him and to be God's child. If we can do anything today to help you make sure that your life is right with God, we welcome that opportunity. We invite you to come as we stand and sing the song selected.